This episode is brought to you by HH Bespoke Spirits, featuring HH Bespoke Gin, Rum, and Vodka. Learn more at hhbespokespirits.com.
This week on Meetin' 3, it's the final episode of our series on global trade. We're thinking futuristically, from China's ambitious plans for a new Silk Road to the future of borders and automation.
If you're a banana, you know, it's easy to cross the border. But if you're a person who's trying to follow the jobs, it's a lot more difficult, if not impossible, to do so in an authorized and safe fashion.
They love food trucks and they love growing your own food because these things are not dependent on essentially government systems. So there's a whole politics to pretzels on the dark web.
Tune in to Meetin' 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. Would like to dedicate this week's episode to Ryan Diddy, who we lost this week. He was a good friend, great colleague, diehard Penguins fan, and he will be deeply missed. So a lot of love, a lot of support to his family and friends. We will miss you. We have a great LA episode this week. Two great guys, one making delicious food, the other making incredible music. First up, Justin Pichurunksi, who runs Anna Jack Tie at a Sherman Oaks with his parents, which will be celebrating its 40th anniversary this summer. He talks about joining the multi-generational business, what it means to work alongside your parents, offering up tips for people who want to do the same, and how his Thai Taco Tuesdays are the talk of the town. Then we hang out with Henry Hall, who plays us some live tracks off his full-length debut, Nito. We talk about his creative process during the quarantine, his fans, aka the Hall Monitors, and we learn a little bit about what it means to move a track out of your back pocket and onto a full length. It's a really fun interview and some really great tunes. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on HRN.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Justin, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule, and welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thanks. Awesome. It's great to be here.
We've long felt at the show that to be a really successful restaurant, one that has longevity, you really need to become a neighborhood spot. And with Anajack High serving food for over four decades, you really ingratiated yourself into the neighborhood and the community. But can you talk a little bit about the importance of the customers and that community to your success and existence?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's just about four decades.
It'll just be about.
Yeah, in July, it'll be 40 years, which will be a real party. Don't know how we're going to celebrate it, but it's true. Like, I think the neighborhood spot in many ways has kept us going for this long. It has definitely contributed to the success for the last, especially for the last year, just to keep us afloat. Like, if we didn't have all of those great people who have been coming every week, and many people, they come every two weeks or twice a week or three, some do like three times a week, and just to see their faces. I mean, I feel like beyond just like tickets or whatever you want to call it, sales, or customers or whatever. It's like, no, like everyone here, they're part of a team. Like everyone at Anajack is part of the team. The guests are part of the team as well. Like, you wouldn't know how heartwarming it is for me to receive these like little things that our guests bring us. Like, we needed lights for our alley, and our guests brought us, hung it, and they're electricians in Hollywood, so it was really easy for them to do. We needed like a little projector set up for this one thing. And these one guests that are like close friends of ours now, like, they brought that. And I realized, the team is not just the team inside the four walls of your place. It's everyone else that's participating in the story as well. And everyone wants to like be a part of it, around it, and part of like the feeling of it, right? And even though there isn't four walls, quote unquote, anymore that you can kind of be in, it's just the idea that like, the family is a lot larger than anything. So, I mean, I think just from an emotional standpoint, it just really warms me to see when stuff like that happens. And I think it is because it's neighborhood and it's not like a destination spot,
Yeah, no, I mean, I absolutely love that. And, your father started the restaurant. Thai food did not have maybe the same recognition that it does now in LA. I would say that cuisine is probably what people from outside the city associate with LA at large. But also, when your father started the restaurant, your parents did, being a restaurant owner didn't have the same cachet it did. So what was it like as a kid with your parents running a Thai restaurant? And what do you remember fondly of being in that environment growing up?
It's interesting. Like, a lot of people ask how it was like growing up as, the kid of an immigrant. Right? The kid of immigrant stories like seems to be something that a lot of people are very curious about. But did you experience, a lot of, I would say, like, tension from the community that you guys are, like, not, you guys are Thai. It's like, is that Chinese? Like, what is Thai food? Like, or like, were you teased because of your food that you'd bring at school, right? Like, I remember hearing Dave Chang's story about how you're like, oh, man, like, Dave's place smells like ass, or it's like all that kimchi. But for me, my personal experience is that my friends were stoked to come to the restaurant, come eat the food. They wanted to have my lunch, when I was in middle school. Like, oh, you want to trade? I'm like, I'll totally take that Lunchables for a chicken satay.
Right.
So I think that I'm very fortunate. I think my sister too, like, we're very fortunate that like we grew up in this environment that people have an infatuation with it in this kind of way that's like, oh no, it's really cool. I don't think it, there, yeah, no, there was no like celebrity status or restaurant owners. Like, my dad kind of looks like a movie star in a way. He's just got this really nice, like handsome look. And when he was younger, I mean, he really had that look. But everyone loved him. So I feel like that party has always been on since I was a kid, and Dad had been the host for so long. And I had been like a party goer in that space since a child, until I had to throw the parties myself.
You know, it's interesting because that hosting trait or service industry trait is sometimes just innate because of your environment, right? Like, you grow up thinking that it's normal to be you know, your parents to be known by everyone in the neighborhood because they're serving up great food and great drinks. And then you move into that, and then you start looking around as you become a restaurant owner or in the service industry, and you go, oh, maybe not everyone opens up their doors to 100 or 150 people every night. Maybe that isn't normal.
Oh, like Dad, you know, when Dad would go out and eat here in the Valley, like, we'd always see like one of our guests like dining in the place that we were also dining. And then we'd have a conversation and we'd meet their family, and we'd have the same exact conversation that we'd have in the restaurant, we'd have at someone else's restaurant with our guests. And it's the same, like, you know, like when we go out on the town, when we used to do that, like Royce and I would, like, we would just go out and like, you'd see a billion people that you knew. So yeah, Dad totally did that way before I did. And now that I think about it, now that you mention it, it's like, oh, I don't know if it's nature or nurture. It seems more like nurture to me now.
Yeah. Well, you know, but that, you touch on that a little bit, and you've talked about it, but not everyone is lucky enough to go into the restaurant industry with having someone who has coming up on four decades of experience. So what have you been able to take from your parents, insights, things like that, that are unique to people who are working in multi-generational restaurants?
You know, it's funny that you say, you know, the question is in some way slightly leading, like, how, like, not as lucky as you to grow up in a multi-gen or in a business that's had 40 years.
Sure.
You understand that, like, it's like, it is lucky. Like, I do have to say I am blessed. You know, when I was really contemplating how I was going to make the full shift here, my friend said to me, he said, like, John, he said, no, like, no one else gets this opportunity. Like, other people are just doing their jobs, but you get the chance to like work with their parents, like in their prime. And my parents are not as much in their prime now, but like, I'm glad that I got to do that and that I get to have those memories to do that. But my team knows, and it's not the first time I said it, that like, sometimes I just want to drop a nuke on it because there's so much baggage that comes with it. There's so much of my father's ways that are still being done that I can't stand, you know, but like, I have to contend with that, that kind of tension between the history of it and my need for a place that has four white walls and one burner, you know, like, so I feel lucky. I also feel that you have to, I think, as an owner, if you're in a multi-generational business, like, you have to weigh how much of the history do you want to respect, how much of the tradition you want to respect versus how much of the innovation you know will overwrite some of that history.
Yeah. You know, you haven't been shy either about when you decided to join the business, that you made some changes to the menu and you did make some adjustments, which, you know, to a business that at that point had been 30 years old with customers who definitely expect a certain type of dish or maybe their favorite dish, and you came in and you said, I'm so sorry, but we might not be offering that dish anymore. What was that pressure like, and how did you work with the loyal customer base and the community to both make the changes that you knew you needed to, right, for the success of the business, but also not alienate your loyal customers?
It's challenging, and my parents remind me about that all the time. The fact that you say they would love you because they haven't met you, but they would love you because, like, they're like, see, other people understand it, Justin. Like, why?
I'm sorry. But that your parents did write me and say, we do have a question that we want to ask Justin.
Oh, my goodness. I love that. Yeah, I think that it's been a struggle because I've seen some customers walk out because they're like, wait, you don't do the barbecue chicken anymore. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I can't do it. It's just like, I'm fat, you know, just us. And they're like, yeah, but your dad would do it. And I'm like, yeah, but like, look where dad's at now. Like, dad broke his back. Like, dad bent over, you know, backwards in order to make stuff happen for customers. And I think that, you know, the original generation of these types of businesses would be very, like, easy to please. Like, my father was easy to, he wanted to please people that came in, so he would do whatever needed to be done in order to maintain their business. That's just survival. But you move on to the next generation, more privileged, more self-centered in some way, and more of an artist, then I feel like, oh, what can I do that's within my abilities that isn't a compromise to who I am and isn't a compromise to the food and to the cuisine? And I do think that the tension between the tradition and the innovation is what creates what I would say the identity of Anna Jack would be, because it's not a takeout place only. You know, it's not like a Thai time Thai restaurant, and it's not like a fancy Thai restaurant. And it's not even a taco stand, but it is kind of a taco stand.
Yeah.
I think it's that, like, all this Venn diagram, like, right in the middle of it. You know, old customers being on one side and new customers being on the other side. Oh, man.
Oh, man. Well, look, we're gonna take a quick break, and we're going to talk about some of those changes, especially you having one of the best wine lists of any restaurant in LA, not just a Thai restaurant, and how you've adapted in the last few months due to COVID and I don't know, Thai Taco Tuesdays, one of the best and most delicious alliterations in the game right now. But we have a song from the archives, and then we'll be back with Justin here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
Palaces and I'm falling, tumbling down, falling down. The palaces and I'm falling all around you. The palaces and I'm falling, tumbling down, tumbling down. The palaces and I'm falling.
Welcome back to Stacky Tunes. We are here with Justin from Anna Jack Tie. Now, you know, we were talking a little bit about some of the changes that you made to the menu back when you joined. But beyond the menu, you've also really added an incredible wine program, which I feel like I didn't see until I got to LA, of, you know, wine being such a big part of Thai restaurants. And I was wondering if you could share a little insight on what made you want to add such a wine program and maybe a larger context of the importance with wine and Thai restaurants in LA.
It's interesting. Like when I look at the old menus, my dad had like Kendall Jackson, AJ, he had like stuff that honestly, like you just can't drink anymore. And I said to dad years ago, like I saved up like a couple $100, like I'm just gonna buy a couple cases of wine and then let's see where this goes. Like I fell in love with wine in Europe, you know, went to Tuscany, went to Bordeaux, went to Saint-Denis, like, and that's definitely not the styles of wine that we serve now, but there is something about an agricultural product that makes me really excited. When I eventually, you know, I walk into the doors at Everson Royce in Pasadena, like the week opened, and I became friends with these guys, and we started drinking, and they started studying for their certified, and they started studying for this and this and that, and I was like, this is a really fun way to see the world. This is a really fun way to like study. This is a really fun way to, you know, be. I just think like it adds so much to the meal when your beverage is so vibrant and tells as much of a story as the food. And I know I'm not the first Thai restaurant to do it. I mean, like Chris had done it for, you know, quite some time before. And the natural wine, you know, our list is very natural slanting. I totally understand that. And it's very interesting to see how that's been changing, because I want to have more styles, you know, I want to contribute to other people's palates too, not just my own. Like, yeah, I drink these types of wines because I think they go well with the food, but some people come in with like a Paso Robles Zin and it's an assault to the palate and they want to eat it with Thai food and they want to eat that with fish. And I'm like, well, all right. But okay, I just think it's a fun, it's honestly the simplest part of the restaurant, because you get to have a good time, you get to taste, you get to learn about the producers, you get to share the stories, you open the bottles, and then done. You know, and you really don't need more than one person to do that, actually.
No.
So there's something so satisfying from a restaurant operator perspective about that too.
Yeah, and it's just nice. I think that people, you know, wine has just exploded, and it's just such a great, you know, realization that it pairs with not just classic Italian, French, you know, American food, is that it goes with a lot of different flavor profiles. And, you know, there are different, as you speak to, wine flavor profiles that go really well with Thai food. And just to learn about that balance and to be like, oh, I never considered pairing these wines or even knew about this wine, because when I only go to these types of restaurants, I'm only served these types of wines. It just expands your knowledge and appreciation of the dining experience as a whole.
A lot of those wines too, they're like multi-generational as well, or they're like second career winemakers, or they're like multi-career winemakers.
Right? Yeah.
Jeff Fisher from Hobbit is also a voice on American Dad. Dan Petrovsky from Massican was an executive at, he was a creative director, I believe, at Sports Illustrated. The guys that make, the family that makes the Pinot Bouvray, they've been making that wine since like the 1700s. And like their son converted the vineyards to organic. And then that son did this and that and that this. And like, it's like, wow, that's such a crazy story. Like that's what I'm doing. You know, that's how I
was going to say, do the generations, the matching generations ever get together to both celebrate and commiserate their parallel struggles of both evolving and keeping the tradition alive?
Yeah, that's a good idea. You know, on I've been connecting with Vanda from Ayara Thai, and from Otis Thai, and all these other Thai restaurants around Romit in Hollywood. And the one that really struck me was when I met with Vanda, and Vanda, you know, she took over her parents' restaurant about 10 years ago, and her food's delicious. They're on the Bicol Mond, and her parents are making food like out of their house to like flight attendants in Thailand, or for Thai Airways International. And they eventually opened up a restaurant. And I'm like, she asked me, she was like, do you feel alone in this journey, Justin? Do you feel lonely doing this? Like, because like you're trying to change something that is so deep inside your family that you want to turn it into this whole thing. And I know how alone that journey can be. So, you know, I feel like the commiseration, it actually helped, you know, because I was like, oh man, you're right. I'm not alone. You know, like other people have done this. And Vanda's done this, and I can always reach out to her and be like, hey, I'm really struggling with this one thing.
I mean, it's just really good to have people who understand that push and pull. Now, one of the new offerings you've been giving up and is Thai Taco Tuesday, which, you know, again, I feel like being in LA, there has been, you know, a couple of well-known fusions between a tortilla that is widely accepted because it is just seen as a service mechanism in many ways, right? To put delicious flavor in. But how did your take on tacos get started? And what has the response been? Because I feel that it's just been growing like wildfire ever since you launched.
You know, when you cook like pad thai every day and you do like pad sews every day, like you know, and I cook with a bunch of Oaxacans. So like, you know, you wonder, what else do I want to cook today? Like, how am I going to impress these guys? These guys see and taste this food all the time. And like, they're probably nostalgic about the kind of foods that they want to eat too. And like, it's funny, like Dad used to do his family meal when he was a sushi chef. His family meals when he was a sushi chef were Thai food. And that eventually turned into him opening a Thai restaurant. Yeah, which is just insane. So I realized I'm doing the same thing that Dad did, you know, like trying to press these books, and I got these tortillas from Princesita. I got this really bomb pork from Pete and Barnett. I'm like, I'm going to make the most badass carnitas that could be made, because, and I don't even want to throw a twist on it. I just want to do carnitas. I did it. I'm like, this is actually pretty good. You know, I mean, I think this is pretty good. Our guests, Bettina and John, they stopped by. This was mid-pandemic. They're like, hey, can we just sit in the back and drink a beer? And I'm like, yeah, sure. Sure, eating a meal, drinking a beer. And I said, you know what? Like, we're doing these tacos for family meal. You guys want to try some? And Bettina's from Mexico. She's like, this is honestly one of the best carnitas I've had in a long time.
Mm.
Like, whatever, get over it.
Like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thai Taco Tuesday. And I'm like, oh my God, yes. Okay, yeah, let's do it, let's do it. And then her husband is an electrician in Hollywood. He hung up the lights. And at first we started out with four tables. And I mean, now it's not that many tables. But I was really dead set on just doing straight carnita tacos with no interpretation. And eventually, we just started to throw more twists on it. It became a big thing where we started to do more collabs. We had the Moosecraft guys come out. We had Avi Q. We had Burke from Slap come out. And we had Johnny from PRD. We just had all my friends, basically.
Yeah, that's what you do.
To come out. And, like, yeah, it's exactly what I do. And I realized at that point in time that the party poster, party planner in me has really, like, I mean, it was during the pandemic, was completely asleep, you know?
Yeah. So
this was a way for us to, like, you know, express ourselves in the way that we felt we wanted to express ourselves. And for me, too. So it was really fun. It was really fun. We just started up again. I think we're on, it'll be the fourth weekend since the reopening will be this next week. And yeah, it's great. It's a good time. We got some heaters out there. Some guest chefs coming in.
A couple of different types of heaters, both in the warmth kind and the chef kind.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, to bring it a little full circle, it seems like you've done a great job of keeping the tradition alive, but improving or moving the restaurant into the future to continue another 40-year run as like a fantastic neighborhood spot. Looking back and also looking forward, what advice would you give to anyone who is thinking of making the same jump? You know, if they don't have a Vonda to call and chat with, and they're listening to this and they're thinking about getting inside the family business, what advice do you give with them? You know, especially since, you know, we're going through the pandemic now, but your restaurant was also around during the financial collapse in 2008, 2009. You know, it's not like the 70s and 80s didn't have their own dark spots of economic turmoil or uncertainty. What would you advise them on?
Whew, I would say reach out to me and Vanda, because we would gladly get a drink with y'all. I think that'd be fun. I think it's a family business is an expression of the identity of that family. So, and every person has their mark on that business in some way, shape, or form. So in order to find longevity in that, you have to maintain the health of all of the family members involved. Mm. And you have to really consider their perspectives. And I would say that my take has been so abrasive because, like, you know, my parents are very hard-headed and they're very stubborn and this is their baby. And just know that, yeah, like, if you take over your family's business, you're taking over someone's like 40-year-old baby, you know, that they've been nursing this whole time. And I didn't realize that until, you know, my parents really said, you know, they really like sat me down and they're like, we have ideas too, you know, like, you know, even though we're not in there now, the pandemic, like we can think of things, you know, we have dishes in mind, and Dad still has many dishes in mind. And I have to remind myself, as you will have to remind yourself, like, you know, consider that anything can be an inspiration. Like, you came into this because it was inspiring to you to do this, right? you have to like really try to capture that feeling in a jar. Remember that there's no greater inspiration than the loved ones around you right now. Like you can look at books and you can listen to podcasts and you can read some articles and stuff, but like there are some gems that you're not seeing and you take it for granted. They're right under your nose. And they're right here with your loved ones in front of you. I say that as sort of like regrettably speaking in a way, because I know I haven't done that. So yeah. A good reminder for myself.
Yeah, you just play back this tape whenever you're going like, what do they want to do? But it's a good, you know, that's a really beautiful thing. And I think that's a beautiful sentiment to sort of end on. You know, congratulations to the upcoming 40-year anniversary. Can't wait to swing in again and can't wait for this pandemic to be over and we can actually eat in the restaurant or in the alleyway at least. If people want to check you out or follow along, you and me both, or see what because you announced the weekly Thai Taco Tuesday menu. Where can they follow you? How can they get more information?
More information on our Instagram is probably the most transparent way to find out info, and that's at Anna Jack Thai Food, AnnaJakThai Food.
Awesome. Well, Justin, thank you so much. We have another song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
This episode is brought to you by HH Bespoke Spirits. The award-winning and critically acclaimed Tailored Spirit Collection features HH Bespoke Gin, Rum, and Vodka. The Black-owned Fashionable Portfolio is a lifestyle brand extension to fashion and retail companies 5001 Flavors and Harlem Haberdashery, HH Bespoke Spirits is available for sale and to ship nationwide. Learn more at hhbespokespirits.com.
Henry, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and chat with us. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you. I'm very, very glad to be here. I love snacks.
Yeah, we're, I mean, it's more private snacks now, but we used to have like a whole pizza, beer setup in times gone by.
Oh, indeed. Like in the studio when you would.
In the studio. Yeah. We'd usually have like donuts or pizza or, you know, tacos or things like that. It wasn't just a name only. How about that?
You just described my food pyramid.
Yeah, it's really good. It's when I eat that way, my body looks like an inverted pyramid, and it just all slopes down.
That's the point of life.
That's the point of life. So, you know, we always ask for bios when we have people on the show just to get a background. And I just have to read the first line of your bio because I've never had a more appropriate artist statement for the time, but it says, wouldn't it be great if an artist's music could hold your hand through an anxiety attack and then help you laugh it all off once it's over? Now, if that isn't the most appropriate type of music artist I want to hang out with during these COVID times, I don't know what is. But how did you land on that? And how has your music been helping people during what is arguably one of like the roughest times of recent history? I wouldn't even say memory. Yeah. I'll go straight to history on that one.
We're hitting the history books.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. I mean, well, I think that naturally, a lot of the sort of new, not to use this belabored term or phrase, but the sort of new normal things that people we've all entered into are sort of habits that I'm kind of drawn to begin with, like regardless of there being a lockdown or quarantine.
Sure.
I'm always fighting against my incessant urge to be completely solitary and like antisocial. Or antisocial is maybe it's more of like introversion, like extreme introversion, kind of.
I get that.
Yeah, and so I think I have already had some experience, like existing the way that people most, you know, everyone started to exist in uniform, like during quarantine,
right?
And so I felt motivated to be making music during that time. Like I felt almost like, okay, I'm comfortable in this space and like existing this way. And like, I think I might be able to be creative, despite the terrible things that are going on. And maybe I can, you know, make at least one person's day a little better by going live on Instagram. You know, I was a big part of the proponent of going live. I actually, I did a live Instagram show every single night for the first like 2.5 months of quarantine.
How was that on you as an artist? And was there pressure at some point? Because, you know, there's been that creative balance, right? Of where people are like, oh, I have this time and I'm home and I have to do output and support fans. But also people go like, I also want to hide in a hole and not have any output or not have people, you know, especially as an artist who makes music that people enjoy, be their crutch in any way. Like, I just need me time.
Yeah. I think I sort of treated it as when I was younger, my dad would say to me, it's sort of corny, but it's true. And it's definitely an effective thing. He would be like, when you go to college or, you know, you're living on your own, if you commit to making your bed every single day, you will be able to look back on each day and say, no matter what happens, you can say, you know, even if you get indicted for fraud or whatever, something bad, whatever.
Yeah.
You can say, at least I made my bed today. At least I did one productive thing. And yeah. I sort of viewed the Instagram lives as that as well. It was like, okay, if I can take 20, 30 minutes out of my day and do this, that is a good day, no matter what, no matter what else happens, I think. There was like a little small little community of people that would tune in most nights, and they nicknamed themselves the Hall Monitors.
Ooh.
Which I enjoyed.
Like that.
I agree. And from there we started the cult, and it is going strong.
Wow.
Not actually, but
that's a good fan club name, by the way.
Yeah, it's not bad. No. I was pretty happy with it. So, yeah.
I mean, during this time, though, creative inspiration can be a little bit hard to come by. Mm-hmm. What have you been pulling from? Where have you been looking, especially as I would say you are maybe more of an intermediate to expert level of solitary creativity, as you say. Mm-hmm. But even this might push the boundaries of where you can get inspired.
Yeah. No doubt. No doubt. I mean, all of my what I've been saying about like being comfortable, being quarantined, yeah. and whatever, that all comes with a disclaimer that it was still a somewhat terrorizing time for me as well. It's not like it was easy or something, but it was like I had some experience with it, I guess.
You recognize that mode a little bit. You're like, I understand. I understand what this is.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And I guess, you know, that's a good question. I don't – creative inspiration for me is really random.
Mm.
It can come when I'm – well, I'll say this. It's quite random, but the majority of the time it comes – when I'm at one end of the spectrum of like emotional stability or the other.
Fair enough.
I'm either really depressed or I'm like exuberantly happy, you know, like I'm usually like in those modes of being, I would say, when I'm feeling creative. So there was a lot of like up and down, I think, like in this time there was, you know, you're free from certain obligations, I guess, maybe like social obligations or something, which was freeing and could be was sort of exciting for me. So that's that. And then also I would at the same time be really down and like
lonely.
Feel like a dark cloud over me, yeah. and feel extremely lonely. And yeah, exactly. And so yeah, I think that oscillating between those poles of existence gave me some creative inspiration, maybe.
One more question before we get into the first song, but
sure.
Since the inspiration emotionally is at the opposite end of the spectrum, mm-hmm. is the result the same? Can you write the same type of song depending on which side you're on? Or if I'm on this happy side, this is the type of song I write, but if I'm on the more sad, depressed side, this is the song I write? Or is it just you get to that state and the creative output can go either way?
It's pretty random. Again, in terms of the actual substance, like of the tunes, I would say for me, sad music can be like the biggest boon while you're sad, you know. So because you feel less alone or what we, you know, that's a whole nother topic, but I've written things that are both really up and really down during this time. And they've come at, you know, it's basically random, you know, maybe that's the beauty of it.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. It's like you just need that emotional trigger. We're going to talk more about your debut full-length Nido later in the episode, but the first song we have up is Tattoo, which is off the album. What's the quick story behind it, and, you know, what do you love about it?
Yeah, this is the fifth song on the album. There was a moment where I wanted it to be the first single. Mm. I think when I wrote it, but it turned out to be harder to record kind of than I thought it would be. Not that like I'm not happy with the recording, but it just became more of a deep cut, I think, like after all was said and done. Regardless of that, it's a song about indecision. I'm not nearly decisive enough to get a tattoo. That's the first lyric of the song.
So well, there you go.
It's a song about indecision.
All right. Well, here we go. Henry Hall, Tattoo Live here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
Not nearly decisive enough to get a tattoo. That's why I decided to come to you. Cause you're not the kind of guy who's really trying to try to mark his body permanently. So I am asking you to draw on me with a Sharpie. Ooh, girl, I see. Tattoo. I mean, maybe this is just repeat my age to love. See, I am the kind of guy who's kind of trying to try to fuck himself up, you know. I can't believe it's been so long since we sipped from our sippy cup.
And normally I'm with a band, so I have a backing band over which I can play a guitar solo, but I don't have them right now, so I'm going to sing the guitar solo. It goes like this, okay.
Thank you for that track. Super great. Always. I would say the one benefit of doing the show a little bit differently now in quarantine is we're getting different versions of the songs that we would normally get. And it's, you know, that's a great thing about live music, right? Or like recordings during a specific era, you get a certain type of song that you may, or version you may have not gotten in any other time or any other situation.
Without a doubt, that's a bedroom track through and through.
Yeah, but I mean, that's who doesn't love a good bedroom track?
I agree.
There's a certain intimacy to that type of recording and to ideas coming out of a time. You put out a really great EP called Quarantine Covers for Black Lives Matter, which I thought was really powerful, really inspiring. I'd love to hear about how that project came together. What made you want to put out, that group of songs?
Yeah, sure. Well, those are all tunes that I love still. And I thought that, you know, it would be a good way for me to contribute to a cause that I fully believe in, and you know, one where I don't want to commandeer the conversation by any means, but one where I hope I can contribute and offer allyship in the best way that I can. And I thought that this is the best thing that I can do, is make music and use what I, you know, my platform for good, for Black Lives Matter. So I put together those tunes in my bedroom again. On the old laptop. And it was really, really fun. All the money went to Black Lives Matter, the Los Angeles chapter. So,
I mean, that's amazing. I mean, I think it's, you know, always good to lend your voice when you can. I know it can always be a tricky conversation or a tricky way to, like, how am I doing this? Am I doing this right? But I think,
yeah,
supporting and showing that support, especially something that, you know, creating music, creating art, and giving it that collection of songs, a title like that is very powerful. How did you pick the songs for the album? You know, it's a great selection. What went into your process
for that EP? Well, I wanted to make a sort of cast a wide net, like, sure, make a big, you know, big range of tunes. So each one is very different. And I figured, you know, and I'll say this, going back to the Instagram Live thing that we talked about in the first segment, they were tunes that I had played, a couple of them I played on the live show and gotten good responses for, especially the Grimes cover.
Yeah.
So that gave me a little bit of a window into what people might respond to. So I was like, screw it. Let's make some fake drums and do these songs for real.
Yeah. I mean, it's when going back to what we talked about before, you know, especially when the pandemic was hitting with all the Black Lives Matter, you know, protests and conversation that were going on, sometimes it was tough for people to connect or to grab onto something. And so it's nice when you're like, I don't know where to put my feelings or emotions and turn that into a project. What were the reactions from people? Like, were people appreciative, you know, were people like saying like, thank you for just making something for me to latch onto, even if it was momentary?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I wasn't in it to get feedback in the way that I am, like, from other music that I put out, of course. Obviously, not that you were insinuating that or anything like that, but the response was great. And, you know, it was right in the crux when people were, when the protests were, you know, at their height. And I got to, you know, also be a part of that. And I made some like care packages and stuff and dropped them off. I couldn't actually go to any of the protests because I see my grandma's really old, and I see my parents live near her, and we see her like every day.
Of course.
So I couldn't really risk that, but I got to contribute in that way too. So it was all, I don't know. It was all like a, it was a positive mix of activities and feedback, and it was great. This was a nice little way to sort of mark that time creatively.
Yeah, you know, when you do a project like this, that, like you just said, it's inspired by a certain time or a certain moment. How does that go on to influence your original work or future work or things like that? Like, what do you pull or what do you remember from these very of the time type of projects versus something where, like Nido, you're like, debut album, this is something that's part of like the bigger canon that you've been thinking about for a while. What inspiration do you pull from yourself on a smaller project like the quarantine covers?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, you know, an album. The question, like, what is this album about? Is right. Never a good question because yeah. it's not like other creative things, other creative output. It's like it covers such a wide range of experiences, and like you've worked on it for so long, and you're potentially, you know, bringing in songs that you wrote years ago to sure. the track list, and
especially for the first one.
No doubt. Yeah. It's like you have a sort of backlog. I definitely had like a backlog of songs, and I was like, yeah. this is a good, you know, I want this on my first album, even though it's, you know, X amount of years old. To be honest, this was really the first time I had put out a project that was sort of like so temporally specific, you know. Mm-hmm. All the EPs and everything that I had put out before that, and Nito included, which came out after the Quarantine Covers EP, you know, were like just a sort of best of my life, you know? So it was a, I don't know. I would say it definitely stands to represent, like memories of a period of time, like much more accurately, I think for me personally. Yeah. And like, I can listen to that and I really go, but you know, I made this songs in a week or two, you know, I was working on them, and it wasn't a project that spanned like I said, over like a year and a half, 2 years or whatever, like an album is. So whenever one of those songs comes up or whatever, I'm like, oh wow, yeah, this is like, I get brought right back to that period of time making them.
I love that. It's a very poignant sensory type of trigger when you're mm-hmm. like, that was a time in my life, and not like, yeah, I wrote the first version of this 6 years ago, and then I noodled with the bridge 2 years after yeah. that, and you're like, yeah, this thing sort of bleeds over the years. Well, yeah. Let's hear another track from sure. Nito. California is the next one you're playing for us. What's the quick story behind that?
Story behind, so, well, this is at this is a great example, actually. Look at that. Look at us being connecting the dots here.
Look at us connect the dots.
I think this is the oldest song on the album, or wow. Monica is the oldest song on the album. This is the second oldest by only like 6 months.
Sure.
And yeah, it's one that I wrote in college, and it just always stuck with me, and it never quite, you know, I would write other songs that had similar arrangements to it, and they would sort of leapfrog it to be put onto an EP or like just put out or whatever. Like Wyoming is another song of mine, that's another state song,
yeah,
that sort of, like I said, leapfrogged California. If California was sitting there waiting in the wings kind of to be released, and Wyoming came out instead. And it just felt appropriate to put this one out on Nito, because it's a meaningful song for me. And I thought it could sit nice and pretty in that sixth track spot.
Amazing. All right. Well, here we go. Yeah. Henry Hall, Nito live. Track is California on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
When I think of California, my heart fills with desire, 'cause I like girls in cars and sun and stuff like that. That's why I keep coming back. it's not 'cause I like it.
Welcome back. That was just California live from Henry Hall off of Nido, your debut album, which has, I won't say spanned a lifetime, but definitely spanned a good chunk of your life. And I think it's why I always really love debut albums, because you feel you get to really know the person, right? You're like, oh, like this is the best of what they've done so far, right? Like this is like the cream of the crop. You can really feel, and you've even talked about it, just about like even where you're placing the songs and like how much thought goes into that album. what was it like to put out your first album? Like, how did that feel to finally go, all right, world, here's a full length?
It was a relief.
You're like, Mom, Dad, don't worry. I finished the album.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Yeah, man. I mean, it was a long time coming. Every EP I've put out, I've put out three or four or five, something like that. Each one before starting the recording process, I said, okay, am I going to make a full length album? And then I'm like, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. And then I just do the EP. And then next time I'm like, am I going to, should I make a full length? And I'm like, no,
EP. No.
But this time I decided to go full length. And I think the, you know, a big part of it was I started working with my producer, Dylan Bostick, who's a really incredibly talented producer. And he, you know, I became so much more comfortable in the studio because of working with him. We actually went to high school and college together.
Wow.
And always we were always friends, but never like close. And then I worked with him on Questions, Comments, Concerns, which is the EP of original music that precedes this album, precedes Nido. And we just really gelled and were practically finishing each other's sentences like we'd been married for 35 years by the end of that process. And so I said to myself, like, okay, well, this is someone who I could see myself working with in a professional capacity, you know, over the course of 13 songs, you know, and I don't feel like I need to kind of test out the water with some other producer or other studio. Like I know that it works with Dylan and I know he's interested in making more music with me. So I basically said, like, called him one day and said, do you want to make a full length album? And he was totally down.
He's like, thank God, finally pulled the trigger away from
exactly. No, it's true. It's true. Yeah. And you know, and I feel like too, I had, there, like we were talking about before, there were certain songs on the album, like, let's see, Cozy Dying, Sun, Monica, California, 13 Besties, that had been, you know, kind of sitting in my pocket for a long time.
Were you holding them? Were you like, this is too good to go on the EP, I'm going to bank it for when that album comes?
Honestly, yes.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know? It was a combination of that and of writing stuff that was new and being kind of swindled by my own prejudice, preferring like newer stuff.
I mean, it's good, but it's not as good as this new thing that I just wrote.
The
EP's coming out, so let's put the freshie on.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know that.
Love this song with this didgeridoo solo. It's like super cool. Not gonna get sick of this.
Yeah, this is timeless. This thing that I love exactly. This week. This isn't gonna age out. No. So in putting all of the songs that you've been holding out into this EP, it must have been a really good creative release, right? To say, I'm not holding back. I'm not punting on the release of this. This one's no longer being tucked in the back pocket. And you're laying it all at the table.
Yeah, it was a combination of release and relief. I think as well, you know, I figured out a sound that I felt passionate enough about that I would be like fulfilled if it carried through an entire album, which was the sound of Nido, which is this sort of like combination of lo-fi bedroom elements and band elements, which is sort of a synthesis of like a lot of the music that I've put out, I think. And because of that fact, because I had this sound in my head, I thought, okay, you know, these tunes that have been in the back pocket, I'm comfortable like lending them to this style of arrangement and like instrumentation. Like I think it'll serve them well, and it's appropriate for them to be like included in this collection of songs.
You also got to go on Fallon, which
yeah, I did.
You know, Mazel Tov, because that's incredible.
Thank you.
And a really great performance too, right? Which sort of thanks. Double-edged sword, right? Because, you know, obviously you want to be in the studio and you want to do it with the Roots and Jimmy and being there. But you were also able to show a little bit of your visual creativity, which comes through in your videos that you make for the songs. What was it like getting to be on Late Night? And what was it like doing that type of performance?
It was surreal. I still don't really believe that it happened.
I saw it on YouTube. It's definitely real. As I talk
to you now, I'm like, yeah. Okay. Okay. All right. Well, maybe you're, you know, just part of a network of people trying to make me feel good or something. I don't know.
It had views, but, man. It wasn't just me. It had a good number of views.
Okay. Good. Okay. All right. I could breathe easy. Yeah, man. I mean, it was, honestly, all credit is due to the crew and our directors, Hannah Baker and Ethan Young, who helped me put the shoot together and led the charge, because it's not easy to shoot something during quarantine, during COVID times. You have to be incredibly vigilant about how you go about things and keeping everybody safe. And they were able to do that and, create something that really services the song, I think. You know, it was their idea to incorporate that day for night look that we shot it all during the day, but we color corrected it to give it that sort of almost like Douglas Sirkian, like 50s, 60s melodrama looking day for night look for half the song. And then it's, you know, splits open into the that like warm day look. So yeah, it was great. And it also, you know, just to give you, I guess, a little preview into where my head is at now creatively, like playing with a band and slightly reworking Alive Annoyed to fit into a band atmosphere and a band arrangement was like a really exciting experience and something I had missed doing. And I found that like constriction of working with, okay, we only have two guitars, bass, drums, and two background singers. Like, yeah, let's make this song full and let's make it work. I found that to be like really inspiring, and we came out with something that I honestly like it more than what's on the album. Like, we sped it up, we you know, stripped certain things down, and it just sounds so full and big. And Dylan Bostick is the other guitar player, and he produced it and produced the music for it, and I just think it came out so well thanks to him. And that's something that I want to lean into for this next batch of tunes that I'm cooking up.
Amazing. Well, yeah. You know, the great thing about that is every time you hear that version of that song, you'll think right back to that moment.
There you go. Yeah. There's a specific time. There's a timestamp on it.
There you go.
Just like the other stuff. Yeah.
Just like the other stuff. But listen, thank you for taking the time to chat with us. I want to make sure we get in one more track, which I believe is 13 Besties off Neato. But if people want to get the album, get some cool Neato masks, which are very apropos, or sign up to be a a hall monitor, where can they go? Where can they find you online?
You can, for all merch stuff, you can just go to my website and click the shop tab, henryhallmusic.com. You'll see shop there when you're on that homepage. Give that a click. And I'm everywhere, baby.
Awesome.
I'm on Spotify. Come
Wonderful.
On.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. Here is 13 Besties live on Stacky Tunes on HRN. We will see you next time.
I got what you need, Nelly. You can count on me. Kathy, anything for real. Freddie, put your trust in me. Raymond, anything you want. Amber, I'll get for you to flaunt. Xander, just a twist of life. And just time after time. Best friends do, and despite what Amber said, oh Bill, there are 12 other friends. Bill, there's only you.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.